Hampshire Public Radio News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Are there ethical limits to biotechnology? Most would say that some advances in this field have brought us benefits. The artificial hip has meant less pain and more independence to those who used to suffer. Cochlear implants have helped people hear better, and even a drug like Viagra has reinvigorated the sex lives of the over 60 crowd. But how about when that drug is steroids and the user is a baseball player? Is that cheating? Does it take away from the human achievement connected with the sport? Or does it matter if everyone's taking the drug? How about genetic engineering? Expectant parents can already tell if their child is predestined for dozens of disabilities and diseases, but one day scientists may be able to alter a gene so that unborn child does not meet that fate. But how far should we take it? At some point, are we playing God? Could we go even further with parents picking the features they want for a child, the way they might customize a new car? What new expectations might that bring? How about cloning? Some see the possibilities it could offer to a family or a single parent. But does that also lead to moral, religious, or emotional issues that go beyond the parents' desires? And if there are certain limits to biotechnology, who is the one to draw the line? And for what reasons? Are they moral reasons, ethical reasons, medical, theological, or political reasons? Today in The Exchange, it's our once-a-month philosophy series, The Socrates Exchange. And again, the question we're examining, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? Let's get your thoughts. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. The Socrates Exchange is funded in part by Bank of America and the New Hampshire Humanities Council. And my co-host this hour is Nick Smith. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH, advisor to the Socratic Society there, and project advisor to us here on the Socrates Exchange. And Nick, it's always nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Morning, Laura.
Well, what are we talking about, Nick, when we talk about biotechnology? This seems like a huge field.
If we take the very, very long view of history, sort of just think of, say, the universe is 14 billion years old. The Earth as a planet is, say, about 4 billion years old. Humans have been using some kind of tools for about 70,000 years, right? And we have more and more and more refined tools that enabled us to control nature in various kinds of ways. In the last 100 years, humans have effectively doubled their life expectancy. And when you start to appreciate the rate at which biotechnology is increasing in its power and its ability to control nature, it's a good time to pause and start asking, where exactly is this technology taking us? Right? We see just, you know, in brute facts, if we're doubling our lifespan in 100 years, where, you know, in the 18th century, people were living sort of late 20s, early 30s, and that was pretty constant through most of human history. If we can double our lifespan in 100 years, where will we be in terms of our biotechnology in 50 years down the road, 100 years down the road? What is the conclusion of this process? Because some people, some rather prominent philosophers of science and biology, claim that we will solve the problem of medicine. Right? We will solve the problems of health, and we can actually solve the problems of human death.
So right? we live forever?
If that's the holy grail of biotechnology, is this a path that we should be going down? Where would we be drawing the lines in that regard? Right? We can see in any step along the way, it seems to make sense to make people healthier, people stronger, people smarter, people living longer. But where is this ultimately taking humanity?
Let me invite our listeners again to join us, Nick. And then I have another question. Again, the number here on the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, this month, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Get Socratic today in the Exchange. Nick, so again, what are we talking about, though? You raised some of the questions, but are we talking about aspirin? Are we talking about pacemakers? Are we talking about genetically engineered foods? Are we talking about cloning? What are we really laying on the table here
sure.
this hour?
In some respect, when we use the word biotechnology, the things that come to people's mind are things like cloning and genetic engineering and films like Gattaca and things like that, where sort of imagining really future technology. But just consider today I was driving into the studio And I'm driving in my car, which is in a way a kind of enhancement of my ability to move from place to place, right? It's better than my legs. It's better than my lungs. And I drove by a Starbucks, and there was a line of people in their cars waiting to go to the drive-thru. They're in their bit of enhancement, right, their vehicle. They're going to the drive-thru to get chemical enhancement, right, very powerful caffeine. You know, it's a rather powerful drug that increases our cognitive abilities, and it's a piece of technology that we put in our bodies. And some of them were actually on their iPhones, right, waiting in line, which is a way to augment their hearing, their memory, right? All these things that are so deeply integrated into our daily lives are pieces of biotechnology. And some of those people surely had had LASIK surgery or have artificial knees or any number of things that are completely ordinary now and in just the flow of culture. And when you think of 100 years down the road, what will people be using? How will we be able to draw a line in any respect with regard to where these technologies stop? And one of the most pressing issues is that people generally tend to want these technologies. Right? People want better biotechnology.
To a certain point.
Well, and sort of the little incremental improvements, right? Everyone likes better coffee. Everyone likes a better cell phone. Everyone likes, you know, you want a better artificial knee if you're going to get an artificial knee, right? You want the best one. Where do we draw those lines, given that if people want them, if there are biotech firms out there who are more than eager to, right, create them, sell them to us, right? If there are markets in these things and there's research being done, it seems very difficult to stop this train, right? It would take such a powerful moral, philosophical, theological argument to say enough, right? We've got enough technology and we don't need any more, because going down this road takes us somewhere that we shouldn't be.
Well, again, it's the Socrates Exchange today. The question, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? What do you think? What about some of the issues that Nick raises? Where do we stop the train? We all like caffeine, for example, or artificial knees that help us stay active. So where do you draw the line in saying that some types of biotechnology is good, but other forms are not? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. And just a reminder, Nick, of the role that you and I play in these conversations and that the callers play. This is not like a regular exchange program. When you call that number, we invite you to say what you think. Nick will ask you a couple philosophical questions. I might jump in. It's not as simple as question and answer. We're really examining something here through the Socratic method. Let's take the call now. This is Wendy in New London. Wendy, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Good morning.
I feel that a medical necessity or a medical improvement in one's life is justifiable and should be used. I mean, that technology should be promoted to do that, to improve someone's life and to gain a better quality of life through medical need. I think when you throw in building up muscles to be the best baseball player, then I think that's wrong. I think the line needs to be drawn with a medical necessity and need to improve one's health and lifestyle.
Excellent. This is an essential distinction. Let's push it on a bit and see how far it can take us. So you're drawing a distinction between what some people have called corrections versus enhancements, right? So a correction is sort of, you know, you're fixing some kind of illness or deficiency you have, as opposed to, right, enhancing the human form. Now let's try out a couple examples. Say I'm 80 years old and my vision is starting to falter and I'd like to have LASIK surgery. Is that a correction or an enhancement in your view?
It's both, actually. It's improving this person's life so that you can live your life to its fullest.
Good.
You might not need assistance in another way. You can be more independent because of it.
Good. Now notice what we're doing here, because that's a completely sensible answer. But notice if we say, let's take this 80-year-old's eyes, her lungs, her libido, and let's correct all those to say the level of a 20-year-old, is that an enhancement to have an 80-year-old functioning at the level of a 20-year-old, or is that just making her healthy and correcting the deficiencies that come with age?
That would be an enhancement.
Good. And you start to see, so you're thinking it's the technology is acceptable only if it makes you normal. So we're going to have to define some notion of what's normal for an 80-year-old. And if you're an 80-year-old with the abilities of a 20-year-old, then that's somehow an enhancement and you're superhuman and that's too far?
From my point of view, yes.
Good. So can we go back to the LASIK surgery? Is that too much of a correction? Is it too much of an enhancement? You see how the lines are getting very blurry
now. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a tough issue. I think if it helps a person live independently through their normal life cycle.
Mm-hmm. Normal life cycle, yeah.
That would be a good way to narrow it, perhaps.
Good. Good. And we notice how when you say normal life cycle, just notice how much of a moving target this is, right? Because if a normal life cycle in 1800 was 30 years, right? You wouldn't be having the same type of vision problems.
That's right.
Probably. So when we say a normal, what do you think is a normal sort of life cycle for a human? When should people die?
The times we're living in, of course, as you said. Normal is between 70 and, or 75 and 85, probably.
Okay. So if we have the, say, biotechnology to keep people alive to 70 or 80 and say, you know, we just keep the technology of 2010, we shouldn't really innovate any further to keep people alive to, on the average, 90 or 100. So maybe for you, we have enough right now?
No, I think technology should keep moving forward, but I think the line needs to be drawn to be improving one's current life within the normal bounds of the life, the longevity of the day.
Wendy, thank you so much. It's a tough one, isn't it? And I really appreciate you being the first one to get on the Socrates Exchange with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. The question we're pondering this hour: are there ethical limits to biotechnology? And Nick, I want to go into the break with a very short posting from our website. Ray says, ethics aside, we are playing here. History shows when man tries to fix nature, bad things happen. More with your thoughts on this question. We'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members in Cole Gardens in Concord, helping families start edible gardens with herbs, vegetables, fruit trees, and advice, helping you decorate with living color, online at colegardens.com. And from the Addictions Research Center, Dartmouth Medical School, conducting studies exploring medications for people concerned about their drinking. Information at 603-653-1800. More of the Socrates Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. Supreme Court, the recent ruling on animal cruelty videos, and the latest on Justice Stevens' replacement. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up with a chance of showers, high temperatures upper 50s north, lower 70s south. Then tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain showers, some clearing after midnight. Lows tonight, mid-30s north and mid-40s in the south. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today it's the Socrates Exchange, where once a month we examine one question using the Socratic method of asking questions and more questions. This month we're asking, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? And remember, we're not out necessarily to answer this question, but to examine it. With us is my co-host Nick Smith, Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH and Project Advisor to us here on the Socrates Exchange. And Nick, let's go right back to the phone. Up next is James. Hi, James. Welcome to the Socrates Exchange.
Hello.
What do you think about this? I'm great. What do you think about this question, James?
I did have a thought about this question. And based upon what I've heard and some scientists expressing themselves, and I think that efforts to politicize sometimes scientific areas can be deleterious to our progress in science, particularly when you have people influencing the process that don't know as much sometimes as the scientists. Not that they're perfect, and bad things do happen. However, just because occasionally you kill an automobile accident, there's no reason to return to the horse and buggy as a mode of transportation. And I think competitively, internationally, if we don't maintain our progress in these areas, we're going to lose ground if we allow this to slip into a politically controlled investigation of future progress.
So, James, what do you think about the question? What do you think are the ethical limits of biotechnology, if any?
It's a very difficult question, and I I'm not an expert in this. And for me to say something, I'd have to cite it with some excellent support.
Yeah,
These are individual judgments, but I say it takes balance and it takes the appreciation of all the effort these scientists have done to get to where they are right now, and it can't be reduced to a political process of people having conflicting opinions that have no basis in scientific reality.
James, what I'm hearing in your comment is a kind of worry about government regulation on various kinds of biotechnology, in the sense that, and this is an important point I'd like to draw out. If, again, we're in this climate where scientists are hard at work working on these kinds of research that produce all these products that, as you say, sort of make our lives better. And if consumers want to buy these products, part of what you're saying is, who is the government to tell us that we shouldn't pursue these products, right? If someone wants to make the products, someone wants to buy the products, the government shouldn't be interfering with that sort of research and development and those kinds of consumer exchanges. Let me just ask you then, are there, if a biotech firm can, in the future, we could imagine them producing just about any sort of human enhancement. Yeah. For example, they've produced simple drugs, right? Or rather, drugs that are in their infancy, things like Adderall, right? Adderall is a rather powerful mood-regulating drug that is now rather popular on college campuses because it helps you concentrate, right? It's a piece of biotechnology that helps our brains function at a different, in some respects, superior level. Should the government be sort of controlling how Adderall is distributed, or other kinds of drugs like that that are, people want to use them, students want to use them, adults want to use them? Should the government be in the business of regulating what sorts of biotechnology we consume, or should it just be a free-for-all?
Well, without referring to that particular item, because I don't know enough about it to really comment on it, I say that if it's not going to be produced in this country, the institution that's producing it will simply move elsewhere and they'll market it elsewhere.
Excellent.
Let me
just trace out the consequences of that, because what you're implying is that even if, say, for instance, the United States government tries to regulate human cloning, genetic engineering, any other pieces of biotechnology, say if we get out of the race to develop and use these technologies, other nations, other parts of the world may continue to use these bits of technologies. And if we, say, get off the train, other people are just going to speed past us and we'll be left behind in history. Is that what you're implying?
This is a concern I have, and maybe it's not valid. Maybe they won't go elsewhere and produce whatever products there, or make investigations whatever they're going to be investigating. But I know it's been a problem between the scientific community and the political community, and it can impair progress in the future. It doesn't mean you don't have to have regulation, because you have to protect your citizenry when it reaches beyond the bounds of sanity, the type of behaviors that are going on. We've had thalidomide and other types of agents that have been developed that have had mass negative effect on the population. I think in the long run, you're dependent upon the accuracy of the scientific progress and the ability of these people to develop things, and it's not going to be resolved simply in a regulatory democratic process, especially when many of the people in the society don't know enough to make a meaningful judgment on these issues.
Yeah, let me hear if I'm getting you right. Are you saying that we should trust the scientists and trust the markets and trust the consumers to produce
them to validate what they're doing?
Good, to produce a technology. And in a way, if we can't regulate to stop the use of these products, there is an effect, I think you're implying, there is no way to get off this train, because if, say, the United States government decides to deeply regulate this biotechnology, that we will be left behind historically, and given the competitive advantage that these biotechnologies convey, it would be suicide for us.
I think it takes an educated point of view on the part of the consumer to do this, because it can't be totally driven by a democratic process of of general input by the population. They simply don't have the knowledge to long-term. These take longitudinal studies to find out how they do affect society over an extended period of time.
Well, James, I really appreciate you getting Socratic with us, and thanks for being on the Socrates Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call. What do you think about this question we're pondering? Are there ethical limits to biotechnology? Where do we stop the train? What types of biotechnology are okay? What types are not okay? What about steroids? What about caffeine? What about artificial knees, hips, pacemakers? What about cloning? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. And Nick, let's go next to Londonderry, and Catherine's on the air. And Catherine, what do you think? What are the ethical limits to biotechnology?
I possibly can't see how we could set any ethical limits. It's just human nature. We're going to keep on pushing the envelope. People want to know more. And how can you, as a person or even as a country, say what's ethically right for one person and not ethically right for the other? There's always going to be different circumstances. It's just we're going to have to just see what happens and go with it, because like you said, it's a runaway train.
Good. So you're saying something to the effect of this biotechnology is in the driver's seat of the future of humanity, right? And we are on this train and there's no way to get off. Where do you think this train is taking us?
I have no idea, but I know that we're not going to stop it, because it's in our nature to learn more and to do more and create more. And if there's a need for something, or someone thinks that there's a need for something, it's going to happen.
One analogy that's been drawn to biotechnology is nuclear weaponry. Right, there was a
I was thinking about that.
During the 30s and 40s, right, there was this race to nuclear weaponry, and in large part because of the global political context, but also because science reached a point where it could. Right? We reached the point where we could develop these weapons, and the scientists did. And, you know, frankly, they recoiled in horror when they were used. Right? There's a sense that the scientists are going to make the next innovation regardless of what ethics and politics think. Let me ask you sort of on an emotional level. How does it make you feel? I don't know if you have children or grandchildren. Imagine them living in the context of 100 years down the road, where this biotechnological train is sort of full speed ahead. What do you think their lives will look like? Do you have any sense of what their lives will look like? And do you trust that their lives will be good?
No, I don't trust that their lives will be good. I mean, I'm not saying I think they will be bad. I'm just saying I don't know. And if it is bad, I feel awful that that's going to happen. If it is going to happen, like I said, I don't know. But I can see it happening. If there's a need to create something, it's going to be done. I would hope that in human nature, as we have tried to correct our errors for the past, that we will do it in the future.
Good.
But we don't know.
Just one more question that sort of gets to the heart of things for me is, if you have, you imagine the future of your children and grandchildren, and you don't know what that future is going to look like. You know, if all previous generations had a good sense for kind of what the technology is more or less going to look like, and we could predict that there would be a slow, aggregative process. If we can't even predict in sort of the loose contours what technology 100 years out are going to look like, are you really willing to take that risk? Do you think we as humanity should be taking these kinds of risks with the future of the planet, our species, all of that? I mean, are we really just going to let technology take us wherever it goes without any consideration whether that's good or not?
My ethical opinion on that is yes, because where some bad might happen, some good might happen. We just don't know.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. Great thoughts.
Thank you.
Again, it's the Socrates Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. You know, Nick, we've used the words a lot. Can we stop this train? Should we stop this train? Catherine said, no, we can't. One leading author and thinker of our time says, actually, we can stop the train. Our executive producer, Keith Shields, spoke with environmentalist Bill McKibben. Now, back in 2003, McKibben wrote a manifesto of sorts, warning of the dangers of uncontrolled biotechnology, a book called Enough.
I'm very curious about the fragility of things that seem stable, that we take for granted. And I wanted to write Enough because, in a sense, it was about the possible end of human nature. We take very much for granted the idea that they'll always be something like us, that it would be very hard to disrupt what seems to us this very robust nature that we have. But the more far-thinking of the genetic engineers are quite clear that they would like to redesign that us to make people who aren't shy anymore, or perhaps have deeper religious devotion, or whatever it is that their parents could order up on a kind of menu of options. And I decided to take their prognostications at face value. After all, they're coming from people like James Watson, the discoverer of the double helix, and think about what it would mean to live in a world where human nature were products not of karma or divine direction or who our parents were in the ways that we explain them now, but were instead the products of very conscious decisions. I think there are ethical limits to the use of biotechnology, and I think the most important is that we really shouldn't cross what biologists would call the germline, introduce heritable changes in people's DNA. I think that what we call somatic genetic engineering, taking an existing human being with some condition, an illness or something, and using gene therapy to treat that, is not only acceptable, but an obvious and laudable extension of medicine as we've seen in the past. And so, done carefully, things like the use of stem cells are entirely appropriate. What isn't appropriate is what a layperson would quite correctly call the production of designer babies, of trying to pick for someone else the characteristics we wish them to have. So let's think back to Boston and Patriots Day. There were two events going on in Kenmore Square. One was the Red Sox game, and the other was the marathon going past. Now, think about how our appreciation of achievement in baseball waned in the years when it was a steroid-riddled. Nobody thinks that Barry Bonds is the greatest baseball player of all time, even though he's hit the most home runs, because we understand it wasn't him doing it. It was his doctor that was providing much of the late career firepower. The same thing with the marathon. Imagine a world not so distant where we've been able to engineer people so that they can run more quickly with less pain. Now, in some pure efficiency model, I suppose this would be a gain because you would finish the marathon faster. But if your goal was to finish the marathon faster, you might as well get on a motorcycle and do it. The goal is for 99.9% of people not to win the marathon, but to find out something about who they are in the process of running it, to deal with limits, with pain, exhilaration, with the flood of natural chemicals through your body. That's a very different thing than souping yourself up. And if we can lose the meaning of something as ephemeral as sport that easily, it probably would pay to take some real precaution against losing the meaning of much deeper human things. We're still able to draw some significant lines. We haven't crossed the germline yet. People aren't producing designer babies. We can muster the legal and financial punch to keep that from happening on a large scale if we're serious about it. I make no attempt by diktat to announce where the line should be. They should be decided in democratic fashion by a democratic society. For instance, Canada had a full-on national discussion of this topic that lasted about 2 years and ended up with the parliament deciding pretty much what I think the sensible common sense line is, stopping at the germ line with heritable change. We need to be moving into a world where we think much more carefully about constant expansion of our powers because they can come back to bite us in all kinds of ways.
That conversation with Bill McKibben was produced by Exchange executive producer Keith Shields. 1-800-892-6477 is our number on the Socrates Exchange. And Nick Smith, we have another listener who wants to get Socratic with us, Peter in Hillsboro. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. What do you think? What are the limits to biotechnology?
I think biotechnology has really reached its limit. At this point, we're artificially lengthening our lifespans. The world is already too crowded. I think we need to not stop the train, but redirect the train into more useful technology. Our great minds are doing something else that doesn't need to be done. While we need more clean water, we need better food production, we need cleaner technologies, and I think it's time to maybe divert these energies into improving our lives rather than extending them.
Good. How about, it's one thing to say that sort of generally, and I agree that, we sort of feel like, we have a good deal of biotechnology. Maybe we shouldn't pursue too much more. But how about, say, what if the scientists can come up with a cure for cancer? Is that taking biotechnology too far? Or any number of diseases, for example, Alzheimer's disease and any kind of cognitive deterioration that comes with age, should we just not solve those problems? Do we have enough technology and we should just let people be sick because it's part of being human to be sick and to die and to deteriorate?
Exactly. I do believe that. There's too many people already. The world's getting more crowded. There's no jobs. There's not enough food. Why not let life just take its course?
Good. So maybe perhaps we should even, retract some of the pieces of biotechnology that we already have, right? Perhaps, chemotherapy is a rather invasive bit of biotechnology, and perhaps that was a mistake, right? Perhaps keeping people alive, keeping people healthy, what we tend to think of as one of the primary objectives of biotechnology in medicine, is a kind of mistake that we've taken too far, and we need less healthcare because part of being human is dying and suffering and being miserable, and perhaps the pendulum has swung too far towards making us healthy and happy and all that.
What do you think, Peter? Chemotherapy too far?
We already have the chemotherapy. I can see using the technologies we have to a certain extent, but to keep it's like if you have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You keep making more money, and you keep making more money, and you keep making more money. This is, it's really not enhancing you because you already have enough. I think you have to decide when is enough and when do we start putting the resources towards improving the life of healthy people.
Okay. Peter, thank you so much. And he uses the word enough. That's the title of the book by Bill McKibben, who we heard from earlier. Thank you so much, Peter, and we'll be right back.
My name is Jamie Colan. I'm the garden director of the Fuller Gardens in Northampton, New Hampshire. We've been underwriting with NHPR for 3 years now. We've been really happy with the response we've gotten from listeners. We saw a difference. We saw people coming in and mentioning NHPR within weeks. It's allowed us to draw people in from all over the state and states beyond.
To learn more about underwriting, visit the support page on nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and Company C, enhancing people's surroundings and inspiring them to share the joys of colorful living. Online at companyc.com. And TransCanada, generating clean electric power in New England from wind, hydro, and natural gas. Serving New England wholesale and large commercial customers, 1-877-MEGAWATT. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, with Earth Day this week, we look at President Obama's environmental record and why some Greens are grumbling. Email us your thoughts and comments before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, it's the Socrates Exchange, and we're examining the question, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? Let's get your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. My co-host for the hour is Nick Smith. And Nick, let's go right back to our callers. Jake is calling in from Lebanon. Jake, what do you think of the question on the Socrates Exchange? Are there ethical limits to biotechnology?
Hello. I want to specifically address a limit I'd like imposed on the matter of cloning. Specifically, I think it's important to recognize that people who are essentially clones walk among us today, talking about identical twins. I happen to be one of them. And I think it's important for people to recognize that clones should be afforded equal human rights because, really, the difference between two people of a genetic similar genetic origin is really timing and social context. There's no particular reason to deny any particular rights or treat them as just body part farms or other nightmare scenarios. So I think that specifically limiting what you can do to people who are produced by genetic engineering is a limitation that seems pretty reasonable.
Can you, you're making an important point regarding, you know, naturally occurring twins are, you know, in most respects the same as human clones. Why do you think there is so much popular worry about clones? Why do people get so, you know, freaked out generally by the idea of human cloning? If, as you say, there are clones walking among us, they have all the rights that the rest of us have, we don't treat them any differently. Where does that anxiety come from, do you think?
I think it comes from really two places. One, people who put too much store in genetic predeterminism. And secondly, that people realize that they have their own urge for immortality and like the idea of possibly being able to propagate their identity throughout time by creating a clone, or, you know, whether it's they're actually transferring consciousness or whether they're just continuing to make a series of new children who happen to be identical to them. So because they feel that urge, they get worried about that and worried about being the clone themselves. And I think that brings up an important point when it comes to genetic engineering, is that we should really consider when people have a choice to make new people, it should be placed in a similar context to general reproductive limitations, which is a topic that's not very well discussed in the United States in particular. But it seems reasonable that if people are going to be able to create new people, clones of themselves or what have you, at will, it should be limited by the social and economic context in which they could bring that new person up. Because if that new person is going to be afforded all the human rights, it should be reasonable that we shouldn't allow, say, a 160-year-old person who's about to die to create a clone of himself that isn't going to be cared for by anyone or isn't going to be afforded the same care and material support that a regular child with a family.
Good. You raise a couple important points. One being, I think you're absolutely right that sort of a science fiction and culture generally sort of throws gas on this idea that there is something, you know, evil and nefarious about clones, and that there's a lot of popular mythology around the idea of clones. One of the uses that people have discussed for using human cloning technology is that what it might enable us to do is take particularly desirable humans, you know, those who you think are the, you know, the most fit in whatever measure you have, say they're smart, they're healthy, whatever it is, you know, clone the presidents of the United States or something like that. And you would have, right, if I was a parent, if I wanted to clone a president or if I wanted to clone Brad Pitt or whoever it is, I might, you know, might think as a good example of a human that, you know, better than what we do now, right? What we do now is we roll the dice, right? For most of human history, what people have done when they had children is they pick some mate that was, you know, in some ways desirable, and they roll the dice to see what you get. What cloning would allow you to do is no longer just roll the dice, but take control of nature and produce a genetically desirable being. Are you comfortable with that kind of controlling over nature? Because something different between naturally occurring twins and sort of, you know, twins created in the lab, right, is this, you know, this naturalness, right? Are you comfortable with cloning humans for desirable traits as offspring?
Yes, I'm comfortable with that, with the understandable limit that there really are benefits to rolling the dice a lot. We get a lot of variation that's produced, you know, all the exciting and interesting people we know of in history, and in a world where one can imagine the level of cloning outpacing that of natural mix-em-up, rolling-the-dice reproduction, that would be a problem because we would lose our genetic diversity, and that's important. I can foresee a future where we have, you know, sufficient computational ability to maintain databases of all genetic material and, you know, reasonably keep the dice rolling naturally or not. But because of that, I'm generally comfortable with the idea of producing clones for their desirable abilities, as long as we understand that the expectations you place upon a person because of the genetic history or genetic makeup are pretty fungible.
Yeah, let me just extend that thought a little bit. I think you're right that most people are comfortable with the idea of controlling their children to some extent, whether it's right, you take vitamins when you're pregnant to maximize the likelihood that your child will not have certain disabilities and have certain advantages. You feed your kid organic food because you don't various kinds of ways that you want them in good schools to control their existence. And in a way, genetic technologies are just giving us more ways to control and shape our children. And you're making the important point that genetics aren't everything, but there's something, and I think that's a comfortable thought for everyone.
Well, and Jake, I appreciate you calling. Good to hear from someone who calls themselves a clone. So great thoughts. Thanks a lot, Jake.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And Nick, let's go next to Derry. Graham's waiting there. Graham, you're on the Socrates Exchange. What do you think of the question? Are there ethical limits to biotechnology?
Well, from what I've been listening to, I can't remember that anybody has really gone to the presupposition of there being an ethic at all. The piece by Bill McKibben, he talks about a democratic process by which societies come to certain ideas about what is right and what is wrong. But there's no kind of governor or no kind of control over what if a particular set of people decide that something is right, well, and good, and others decide that it's not, and how can there be a moral imperative at all if it's simply a democratic process?
Good. Let's tease this out a bit. Let's just sort of suppose for a second that we can appreciate that, religious worldviews will have certain opinions about biotechnology and will draw certain kinds of limits, and different religions have different opinions about that. But let's say that there really is no sort of universal moral law or any real compelling ethical code that tells us where to draw these boundaries. And let's say we exist with that comfortably. Even if we exist without any universal moral principles, mm-hmm. Let's just take examples and think how we feel about them. For instance, steroids in sports. Right? Even if you don't have a universal moral code, right? Whatever your beliefs about values are, how do you feel about the use of performance enhancers in sports? Is it cheating?
For myself, personally, yes, but for another, perhaps not.
Good.
The idea, it was Nietzsche who said that, it all comes down to a struggle for power, a will to power over other people. And honestly, without an overriding moral code, it really is simply a will to power, whether it's one person or a set of people.
Good. And so these bits of biotechnology for you are potentially, whether it's steroid use in sports or cognitive enhancements of whatever variety, they're really just a kind of competitive advantage that some people will have over other people. And, that is probably going to be a function of money and power. And this is kind of just an accelerated form of natural selection and evolution. Is that what's really going on here from your worldview? And morality is really irrelevant, that we're just some people are evolving to be stronger, more powerful, more dominant, and nothing's going to stop that?
Well, from my worldview, actually, no. But I'm simply playing the devil's advocate.
Well, what about your worldview?
Coming from a Judeo-Christian tradition, I feel that we were created by a intelligent designer, for an awful term, and there are goals in that. I personally don't find the use of biotechnology in most respects to be nefarious. Earlier when we were talking about, the difference between correction and enhancement, honestly, go for enhancement. I don't find there to be a moral question as to whether or not, choosing your, I'm going to keep my eyesight until, whenever I die. That's not an issue for me, but the question is, in a pluralistic society where it's the voice of the people and you have competing worldviews, and you will always have competing worldviews.
Good. Let me just again, tease this example because it's one thing, and you know, this is a game philosophers often play. Well, let's suppose that Nietzsche is right and there are no universal moral values, but I'm a Christian and I like to think of it this way. When we get into concrete examples, for instance, you know, let's say that you know, we have various kinds of ability to you know, in utero either select our children or engineer our children for various kinds of advantages in size, intelligence, health, etc. And I decide that I'm going to give my children the enhancements. And you decide, being from a certain religious tradition, that those enhancements aren't for me. And say my kids go to school with your kids. Right? And my kids have all the enhancements, and your kids are, you know, the naturals, right? Yeah. Who just sort of are like kids used to be in the 18th century, right?
Yeah.
Aren't my kids going to be getting all the A's, be winning all the races, be getting into Harvard, and your kids are going to be in the remedial classes? I mean, do you really have a choice not to get on this train?
Well, the question then becomes is, what is success? You know, I work with kids, you know, middle school and high school kids. And in doing so, I'm always asking the question, what is the definition of success? Is it more money, more power, and more influence? And I'm just not sure that's the case.
Good.
But if the society has said that it's the case, this is getting off topic, so I don't want to walk down the trail too much, unless you do.
No, it's an important thing to flag, and I'm glad you're raising that question, because what we're asking here is, generally, where is this technology taking us? Which is a version of the question of what is success, what is a meaningful society?
Well, Graham, and thank you again so much for being with us. And Nick, let's take one more. This is Jeff in Alstead. Hi, Jeff. You're on the Socrates Exchange. What do you make of the question? Ethical limits to biotechnology? Jeff and Alstead, are you with us? Okay, it doesn't sound like Jeff and Alstead is with us, so let's try Eric and Conway. Hi, Eric, you're on the air. All of a sudden, our Socrates Exchange has been afflicted with phone troubles.
We went too far.
Are there ethical limits to our phone system? What about Ernst in Concord? Hi, Ernst, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Laura and Nick.
Well, you win the lottery, Ernst. What do you think?
That was kind of weird, wasn't it? I'm a retired geologist, and in that process I taught evolution as part of the paleontological aspect. I'm also an amateur historian, but maybe more importantly now, since I'm retired, I'm a futurist and maybe a fatalist, because my philosophy about all of this is every one of us has opinions about this matter, and they're based in ethics, they're based in religion, morality. And we're all entitled to those. In fact, I tend to agree with Bill McKibben's view. But thinking outside the box, I think where all this is going to go, it's going to be just like Darwinian evolution. Not only are our bodies changing, our physiology and anatomy, but also our minds and our mindsets. So I think we all can posture, we can all argue, converse, as we're doing here right now. But I think ultimately, given enough generations, it's got to go where it's got to go. The alternative, the alternatives are, we're either going to improve life or we will be mired in some sort of Armageddon. We don't know. But it's basically a futuristic issue. And I think we all need to be aware of what's happening and trying to voice our opinions, because that's part of the evolutionary process.
Good. Let me just press this a little bit. If we view biotechnology in the long view of history, and we see it as, you know, a version of, some people have called it accelerated evolution. You know, one important caveat of this is, you know, people, when we think of evolution, we think that evolution has some kind of happy conclusion, or it's leading us to something better. But are you comfortable with the idea that if we allow for this kind of biotechnological evolution, that just as something came before humans, something will come after humans and leave us behind, and that there is, right, humans don't necessarily play a role in the 22nd century, in the 23rd century, and that we will be left behind by our biotechnology because our flesh will become, right, weaker than the technology? Are you comfortable with that conclusion, and do you think it should be stopped, or are you a fatalist and just think that that's the way it's going and we should all just expect humanity to end in a generation or two hence?
In a strange sort of way, I'm comfortable with it. Because I look back on human history, hominid history, and I see those changes, and we are here in the future, many, many generations hence. It may very well be that humans as we know them today will have evolved into cyborgs or some kind of biotech combination with human mind. I think that's where it's going to go. It'll be beyond my lifetime, probably, certainly beyond lifetime of our kids. But it's going to happen, and we evolve to accept those things. And that's my view on it. That's what I basically was teaching my students, to think outside the box, to consider those possibilities.
Well, Ernst, I'm so glad you called. Great thoughts to finish off the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Nick, our next Socrates Exchange will be on May 27th. The question will be, is it ever right to do what's wrong? Max Latona will be hosting that program, and I really appreciate you being with us today, Nick. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nick Smith, Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH and Project Advisor to the Socrates Exchange. Now, a reminder that Nick will be holding a live chat on this question for the next hour, so go to nhpr.org, click on the Socrates Exchange page if you want to continue exploring this question, are there ethical limits to biotechnology? The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, and the Socrates Exchange is made possible in part by Bank of America and the New Hampshire Humanities Council. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Dan Ankeles. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer of both the Socrates Exchange and The Exchange is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.